Okay, welcome to this second seminar in the series for this academic year with the Hellenic Observatory here in the European Institute. It's my great pleasure to introduce our speaker this evening, Professor Bettina Davout. Professor Davout is Professor of Psychology and Director of the Laboratory for Psychological Applications and Communication Planning at the University of Athens in the Department of Communication and Media Studies. She is a chartered psychologist and an associate fellow of the British Psychological Society. We are welcoming her back to London. She did her PhD at the University of London Institute of Education. Bettina is the author of some eight books and the editor of 11 volumes on issues related to her research. And she's published many articles in Greek and in international journals. Let me mention her most recent book, which is entitled "Conflict and Emotion in Interpersonal Relationships." As you can see, and the reason I'm sure whilst you're here is not only the standing of our speaker, but it's also the title, Investigating the Psychological Effects of the Greek Financial Crisis. As is normal, we're inviting Bettina to speak to us for perhaps 40, 45 minutes, something like that. There should then be the equivalent time for questions and answers, discussion, and we will finish by about 7:30. As you may notice, the seminar is being recorded, and it will be subsequently available for downloading. So, without any further delay, I will invite Bettina to speak to us. Welcome.
Thank you very much for inviting me here. It's my pleasure and honor to be here. Just because I'm being recorded, I have some things written. Okay. Together with my colleague Nicholas Demerzis, who is a professor of political sociology at our department, we have been trying to explore the psychological effects of the financial crisis and especially the impact on political behavior since 2011. I said we have been trying because we ourselves live in this crisis, so we don't really have the researchers' objectivity, but we have done our best. Our first research was carried out 4 years ago with the Indignati movement. And what we found then was that what mostly brought people out in the streets was a combination of hope that things will get better and political efficacy, the feeling that people can affect, can have an impact on political processes, which, however, by now, as we will shortly see, both seem to have significantly diminished. Our focus is on emotions. Nicholas from a political psychological perspective and myself from a psychological perspective, so this is interdisciplinary research. And our basic premise is that emotions, by creating a shift in action readiness, bring about changes in attitudes and behavior. Quite early on in the onset of the crisis, we noted that the emotional climate in Greece had changed. By emotional climate, we mean the collective emotions experienced as a result of a society's response to its socio-political conditions. It's not emotional atmosphere, which is another term implying mostly collective emotions towards an outside event. For example, the crisis in the beginning was an outside event to us, so it did create an atmosphere, a particular atmosphere, which, however, settled down to a more stable emotional climate. It's a term we've borrowed from De Rivera, from the University of Clark. In quite a short time, thousands of Greeks were socially displaced, thus losing not only economic but also social and cultural capital. The crisis affected everyday life in a multitude of ways. We know that. And these significant changes triggered powerful negative emotions. In addition to that, media represented and interpreted the crisis effects through a very negative, very distressing emotional discourse from the start. We have written about that in another article together with Nicholas Demetris, which was published in 2013 in English. I can give you the in a book, which I can give you the reference in the end if you want to read about it. Now, given the widespread sense of social injustice and the left radical tradition in Greece, one would expect a massive, organized, immediate, and efficient public response, which, however, did not happen, with the exception of the Indignati movement, which evaporated very shortly after it was severely suppressed. Greeks did not seem to react. Thus, we set off to investigate more systematically the connection of emotions with behavior, and we did three separate studies, which I will present to you today briefly. I want to go briefly through our theoretical model. Okay, this is the emotional climate where we live, all of us live in. And emotions are being generated by different sources. We may feel emotions for non-conscious reasons. Non-conscious emotional processing is a emotional processing which is quite fast, evolutionary older, takes place in the most evolutionary old part of the brain, which is the amygdala. It lasts few seconds, and we don't usually have a representation about it. We're not sure exactly what caused the emotion. We're not well aware of it. Now, within a society and within a particular emotional climate, we often experience emotions without really knowing what really caused them. I think it will become more clear in a minute when I will present to you our first study. So there are emotions at a non-conscious level which make people feel and do things, and there are emotions at a conscious level which are evolutionary more advanced. They take place in the cortex. They're usually connected with a representation. We know what caused the emotion. We have information about the emotion. And they have different sources. At least there are some of the sources. We feel emotions when we evaluate our condition, or when we remember things, or when we imagine that something will happen to us. Now, emotions are the engine of behavior in the sense that they, and this is psychological evidence, it's not in just theory, in the sense that they motivate us to act. They produce a shift, what we call a shift in action readiness. When we feel an emotion, we have to do something about it. But this doesn't always happen, because sometimes the reality is too difficult for us to stand, so we tend to extenuate it with defense mechanisms, like denial. You know, okay, and we did see this in our research, people saying, okay, it's just a crisis, it will not last long, it will not affect me. So if I use this defense mechanism, or if even rationalization, saying that, okay, eventually there will be a solution, the emotion may not be that motivating. Also, emotions may not be motivating when they are so strong that we are shocked. So when we are shocked and when we are in trauma, then we actually become immobilized and we don't act. If this doesn't happen, or if, for example, we may distort emotional reality in the beginning by saying that, okay, this is not going to last very long, but then as time passes, we see it lasting and it begins to affect us personally and we are losing our job, which means defenses collapse, and the reality of the event comes closer, then we may become motivated. But then again, action is not always the result. Because if you want to do something, first of all, you have to be resilient. You have to be able to cope with what is happening. Then you have to believe that your actions will bring change, so you need to have hope. And you also need to have efficacy, political efficacy and social efficacy, which means have some repertoire, know what to do. And be able to assess costs and benefits of your actions and find out that your action will have an effect, and then, okay, we act. And our action brings more emotions, which close the circle. Of course, this is an algorithm. Human beings are much more complicated than a graph. It's just to give us an idea of what we did. Okay, I don't want to say anything more about theory. I will move on to our first study, which was to see the effects of everyday life images of crisis on hope, political efficacy, and intention for action. With this study, we tried to trace non-conscious sources of emotion in everyday life. So we did an experiment. We induced mood to people with photographs featuring everyday life during and before the crisis in two respective groups. We had 150 images of everyday life, 75 per condition, before and after the crisis, which we selected from a total of 206 images, screened for emotional impact on 20 viewers, with a software that detects emotions from facial expressions. For those of you who are familiar with psychology, this is theory. This is Ekman's work on the six basic emotions which are expressed in the face of human beings in the same way all over the world. So there's a particular software which can trace from my face, even when my expression is very, very soft, whether I feel happy or sad. This is the software we used. We had 160 participants, undergraduate and graduate students from our department. And this is what we did. We showed the experimental group images of crisis for 9.5 minutes approximately, and the control group images of what we call prosperity, which is Greece before the crisis. I will show you some of these images. These are images of crisis. Well, they are images we see around when we walk in Athens and the other big cities of Greece, not so much in small towns. And these are images before. So one group saw images of crisis and the other group saw images of prosperity in quotes, and then they were both assessed with a Beck hopelessness scale, which is a scale measuring hope, internal political efficacy, and they also had to answer to four vignettes which we created about possible social problems in the neighborhood. These problems were mobile antenna wiring, conversion of a park into a car parking, increase of violence, increase of litter. We gave them these four problems in the neighborhood, asking them to tell us for how many of them would do something, and then we had an open question, which was, what would you do? And here is what we found. We found that images of crisis in 9.5 minutes that we showed them increased hopelessness significantly. All these are statistically significant results. Increased hopelessness in both age groups, more in men than in women, and more in younger than in older participants. We found also that political efficacy was increased in older participants. They felt like wanting to do something, but decreased in younger participants. And we also found that intention for collective action for public interest matters increased in both age groups, but more in younger participants and more in men than in women. What happened with the intention for action is interesting because in the crisis condition, we found that people were reporting active mobilization even for issues which were not so much important as, for example, the park. And active mobilization meant they wanted to go out in the streets and mobilize people to get to do something about it. While in the non-crisis condition, we found that actions were milder, as, for example, telephoning the neighbor, telling him what is happening, or complaining in social media, even for more significant issues. It was interesting that younger participants in the crisis condition, participants under 22 or younger participants here, exhibit increased hopelessness. Actually, it's very, very, very high hopelessness, especially in younger male compared to international data. Decreased political efficacy, but increased intention for action. And we think that this combination may reflect, of course, distrust in traditional politics and the pursuit for alternative action repertoires, and also it may explain obsession from the recent elections. What I think is interesting in this experiment is that even just walking out in the streets in Greece of the recent years is enough to contribute to hopelessness and apathy and feelings of deadlock feelings about not being able to do much. Now, our second study was to see the impact of news media on the emotional climate. We wished to see how media represented humanistic aspects of the crisis. For example, do they give hope? Do they raise issues that support human pain and distress? We should note that until about the elections, the general elections in Greece, the term humanistic crisis was very, very, very rare in political and media discourse. Almost everybody spoke about financial crisis. And it was after the election, it was Syriza that introduced a discourse about the humanistic aspect of the crisis. And I think this is important because the way we cope with problems depends very much on the words we use to raise the problems. So what actually motivated us to see what is the media doing in that aspect was that there was no discussion about humanistic problems. Here we did a quantitative content analysis in 947 news items, which we screened with indexes of humanistic crisis as keywords. These keywords were material hardship, poverty, inequality, in education and social protection, in accessibility to social welfare, and medical care. These news items were drawn from three newspapers and three news websites, which we selected on the basis of readability and unique visitors for a five-year period. They were Kathimerini, Elefantopia, Ethno, Zougla, Newsit and News 247. Actually, 947 news items from six media over a five-year period is a very, very small number in itself. We had 1,062 units of analysis, mostly text and pictures. And we examined content, dramatization in terms of emotional wording, focus, responsibility framing, whether the event was covered in terms of an event or an incident or an individual, or whether it was placed within the wider social and historical context. And emotions, the six basic emotions, as we detected them in the writer's narrative and in announcements by politicians, specialists, or citizens.
Jenny, can I just ask, how did you select the cases? Were the 940 random?
We used Oh, no, we selected the three newspapers and the three web pages.
Yeah.
And then we used the index of humanitarian crisis as keywords. We put keywords.
Of course, yes.
And then the news items came out from this six. So it was not a representative. It was actually everything that existed, if...
With those keywords.
With those keywords.
Yes, good.
And the selection of the six media was not really representative. It was readability.
Yeah.
We tried to have some representation, but, I mean, between Kathimerini and Ethnos.
Yeah.
It was all we found. Okay, from those news items, 71.8% focused on individual cases of suffering without clear connections to the wider socioeconomic environment. Of course, it is obvious, but it is not stated, so being obvious is not enough. Though some titles were framed thematically, accompanying text was... framed episodically. Here is an example, the crisis killed him, but then it was just gossip details about his business that went bankrupt and things like that. Zungla and Kathimerini focused very much on individual cases. Suicide was the most frequent event in episodic framing, and health system in degradation in thematic framing. 34.6% of the news items expressed a critical attitude towards political parties or political elite. Only 11.7%, it's a very, very small percentage of the total of news items that we had, made reference to institutions or collectives formed to relieve pressure and pain, although we did have many institutions, and we had a lot of collective voluntary efforts of... people to help other people. They were not very much featured in the media. And 4.3 referred to ways of overcoming the crisis. Eleftheropia was a newspaper that was mostly had dramatization in the titles, and Kathimerini the least. Eleftheropia again, dramatization of content. We assessed it by counting emotional words. Here are some examples of dramatization. I have tried to translate them in English. I'm not sure. I hope they will have the same impact as in Greek. People are mowed down by strokes due to the crisis. The financial crisis murders Greeks. Unemployment and shutdown shops strangle the city. Defeated by poverty, an injured mother withered in Mytilene. He died alone at 41 in the darkness of the crisis. The IMF kills Greek children. The supporting visual material was mostly individuals or symbolic abstract themes. I will give you examples in a minute. And they mainly supported texts on living conditions. Some images were featuring institutions... supported texts on health issues, and there were almost no images supporting unemployment, human rights, or civil society. Here are examples of visual material, individuals, and abstract themes. This is a general distribution of visual material to text. You see that... it's mostly health and living conditions and mostly individuals and abstract. Emotions. Actually, sadness, fear, surprise, and anger. Emotions in statements and narratives. Prevalent emotions in politicians were fear or neutral in the sense that they were trying to be objective about what they were talking about. Fear from scientists, sadness from citizens and authors of the news items. Oops, sorry. So here is the general climate that emerges. Main emotions generated are fear and sadness. Main focus is on personal drama, with suicides the most frequent theme. Thematic framing is more frequent in titles, but episodic framing more frequent in text. This is actually very confusing for the reader. It's incongruent when you find a title with being thematically framed and then reading something which is actually focused on the individual in a very dramatic way. It creates even more confusion. And there was rare reference to institutions or collectivities formed to relieve pressure and pain. So this is how media contributes to the climate, not very encouraging and not very supporting. And our next study was to ask the people to see what Greeks have to say about the way they have experienced the crisis. We had semi-structured, in-depth, face-to-face interviews from November 2014 to last June, with an interview schedule based on the model I showed you in the beginning. And we had 50 participants, men and women, aged 18 to 70, with different levels of education, employment, and condition. We actually did maximum variation sampling. We had five different age groups. We tried to analyze the findings on the basis of five different age groups because we have evidence that the crisis have affected differently the different age groups. So the younger individuals, 18 to 24, experienced it differently than older individuals who were already retired and living on a pension. We try to have 10 in each age group to reach some saturation. And the interviews lasted approximately an hour and a half, an hour and 15 minutes, mean of an hour and 15 minutes. We had only 7 unemployed in our sample. It's not representative. We actually should have more. These are the prominent emotions reported. I don't need to read them again. They're negative emotions. But it was also joy. And that was a joyful surprise. Participants who had been involved in some sort of form of collective action said they were happy during the action. It was a source of gaining energy, positive feelings. The emotional climate is very nicely illustrated in the quotes of a participant, and this is why I write it here. I have other quotes which I will only read. I have a feeling, he said, that they have thrown out over people a collective guilt, so to speak, a guilt that spreads like smog and crumples us up and grieves us because it beclouds our sky. Another participant said, I pass by my previous neighborhood and see the shop shut down, locked. Such a misery. I feel really bad. I feel grief. Triggers of emotions were evaluations as individuals evaluate their personal condition. And remembering, I want to read to you two participant quotes here. Evaluations, he said, he's a man of 43, as the time passed, I became more and more angry with the situation and with myself, that I had probably done the wrong choices. And remembering, this is a 25-year-old woman. I was looking at the queues outside the food supply center, she said, and wondered, what is this? Is it a new famine? Decent people like you and me, are we under some kind of occupation? It is like what my grandpa described about the Red Cross meals during the war. Imagination, which was very, very much excited by rumors about catastrophic scenarios, and we know that a pending catastrophe may be often more emotionally exhausting than the catastrophe per se. I feel strained and anxious to think that I will get up tomorrow and may not be able to pay my rent, says a woman of 32. One day the unemployment benefit will stop. What happens then? Will I find a job? What am I going to do? There is a point when you can imagine yourself in this condition or someone closer to you, close to you, and then anguish and disappointment become more intense. And with empathy, we had two trends. I think this is a very interesting finding. Some participants showed what we call inhibition of empathy. They seemed really desensitized and focused on personal struggle for survival. I have an interesting quote to read to you here. She says, it's a man of 35. Compassion I feel no more. It has become a routine. It has to do with our survival. That if we were to respond at the call of every beggar, we would have to spend 30 euros per day and to listen to their stories more than 6 hours. There is a comedy in this tragedy, a farce. I was thinking that the beggars are like pigeons. They come and eat the breadcrumbs, and they're so annoying. And only if you chase them away, they will leave. It's a tragedy and a comedy at the same time. And of course we had motivating empathy, participants who were much more motivated to have to do something, who couldn't stand, as they say, to see children fainting at schools or more and more people becoming homeless. In discussions, again, we had two trends. Some people wouldn't talk about it, and it was like a defense. That was mostly participants who have been affected the most. And all those who were not clear about what happened to them, and they're quite politically confused. They prefer not to talk, they prefer to discuss, as they say, other things, to laugh, and don't speak about problems. And there were participants who talked it out to relieve emotions, to understand. Those were mostly participants who express their relatively stable political ideology, mostly leftist, personal and political efficacy, and those who could tolerate emotions generated by discussions. Implied feeling rules, both at the personal and the sociocultural level, mostly generated fear and guilt. It was Pangalos who said that we all ate it, and we don't need any other example for that. And violations of norms, changes in social and financial policies that threaten stability and sense of control. People can't go to, of course they can't go to private doctors anymore, but they can't even find places in public hospitals because the staff is being fired. Services are being reduced and people have to wait for months to be able to make an appointment at a public hospital. So this is a violation of norms in the sense that things are not as they used to be. Am I okay with time?
Seven minutes. Thank you.
So, now, do these emotions lead to action? What we found was three trends. For some people, they lead completely to inaction. I will explain in a while who are those who are mostly affected by that. Atomocentric action for personal or interpersonal purposes, and sociocentric or political action. Inaction was mostly for participants immediately affected, shocked, or traumatized, where emotions were frozen or neutralized, or with participants in double bind. We had many participants who said they felt being in a double bind. Acting against the measures would mean a Grexit. Not acting would mean more measures. So these first two groups were actually immobilized. I will give you some examples. of quotes. I didn't expect it to be so profound. Our lives were being attacked. I could have never imagined that. An attack at our everyday lives. This is a 57-year-old architect. His wife was also an architect. They were both freelancers, and they closed down their office. So they don't work anymore. And it was also, participants who distanced emotional reality of the situation, as we said before. I will read a quote. I must admit, that is a man of 70, I must admit that in the beginning, I thought that this would last a few months. Okay, it's just a crisis. It will be resolved, thank you. Obviously, that was wrong. I wasn't really aware of what all this meant. Atomocentric action for personal or interpersonal purposes was mostly participants with resilience, psychological resilience, meaning that they had the plasticity to adapt to the situation, they could tolerate the situation, and they had the potential to cope and try to recover whatever harm was caused to them, with personal but not political efficacy, with no hope for change, and with what we called quasi-political tendencies in the sense that they thought they were acting politically just by complaining, not announcing, complaining in social networks. I will only read you two quotes which I think are interesting, about one about political inefficacy and the other about hope. This is a woman of 33. I took part in demonstrations because I felt that my country was sold cheap. There was no way I wouldn't fight that. But that was not effective. Whatever is to pass, they will vote for it to pass. The end. So what else should I do? Should I go out and start yelling so that my anger goes away? Will I make something of it? No. So there's no reason to fight it, knowing the result beforehand. And about hope, that this is a man of 33. There is no future. There is no hope. This is the worst. No future. Now, this is a quote in Greek, which I translate in English, but when he spoke Greek, he used English, saying, no future. This is what most of the people experience, despair and uncertainty, he said. And finally, it was sociocentric and political action for participants with psychological resilience, political efficacy, hope, and relatively stable political orientations. At the beginning of the crisis, participants already at a disadvantaged position thought it as an opportunity for restoration of social justice. Some told us that. By time, they lost hope. Those immediately affected were traumatized. Those not immediately affected, crisis obtained increasing emotional reality as defense mechanisms collapsed and all the crisis touched them personally. This resulted to changes in political action during the different phases of the crisis. Our participants were generally low in optimism. Actually, Greeks score higher on hopelessness scales, again compared to international samples. This is not from our study, it's from another study. With the exception of some interviewed around the January 2015 elections who expressed cautious hope, you may remember that Syriza used hope as a slogan. It was their slogan. Participants, and especially those over 55, reported to feel quite resilient due to past experiences of recovery from distress. Highest political efficacy was reported by the youngest and the oldest age groups. This is interesting because the experiment showed us lower political efficacy for the youngest group when exposed to images of crisis. So it seems as in an unconscious level, their political efficacy lowers, but they think that it increases, perhaps because they, in the back of their mind, they have the alternative political action for which the new repertoires they are looking for, perhaps. For older individuals, it seems to be connected to a pre-existing political ideology, while for younger, seems to try to diffuse negative emotions in seeking new action repertoires. Middle-aged groups are those who appear to be mostly confused and uneasy in terms of political efficacy. They don't know who and in what to trust and feel their actions have no political impact. They actually feel they live in a corrupted country. Instead, they feel quite efficient to invest on personal goals and on interpersonal relationships. Actually, they are the ages who leave Greece. They flee. Well, there's one statement with which I would like to conclude, and this is that it seems to us from these studies that together with financial recession, we live an emotional recession in Greece. And that what is, regardless of what will happen in measurable terms, in terms that have to do with the financial development indexes, what I think is very important is to be able to reverse the emotional climate, because it's only with positive emotions, without, we know that in psychology, our mind functions effectively and we can think logically and be creative and solve problems when we are in a positive emotional mood. It seems that within this negative emotional atmosphere, it's very difficult to expect from people to be able to find solutions to the problems. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you, Bettina, for an important presentation, a very clarifying presentation, and a moving presentation as well. So thank you for that. Given the nature of the topic, I'm sure there are many questions and comments people want to make. So I'm going to throw it open straight away. If you could simply indicate who you are, etc., we will take the questions as they come. Rebecca, please.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Bryant. And I can't say I enjoyed the talk. It was very, as Kevin said, an important talk. I sort of feel like we were also having an experiment done on us, and that I now feel very hopeless having listened to the talk. But I have two questions about one about methods and one about your conclusions. Of course, with the first study that you talked about, with the images of crisis and images of prosperity, you only showed us a few images. But one thing that was striking to me about the images that you showed to us is that in the images of crisis, or rather, in the images of prosperity, you saw people who were happy and were active, and so on. Whereas in the images of crisis, you saw people who were quite still,
yes,
and blocked.
You're right.
And passive. And so I wonder if those images themselves don't actually predispose people to certain reactions.
That's true.
I mean, if you watch images of those type of that type for, you know, 7 or 8 minutes or 9 minutes or however long they were watching them, then it seems to me that it would, in a sense, predispose you to feel certain things.
We actually tried to do this. Although the images I selected, I'm not sure are representative of the total number of images.
Yeah.
And there was an image here which was quite active. There was a demonstration, a woman in a demonstration. Do you remember this image?
Yes.
But anyway, but in fact, what
but
we tried to
but
do...
But it's also blocked. You mean the one with the
yeah,
police?
But, yeah, but she's
yeah,
blocked
so
by the police.
Yeah.
You're right.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, this is why we did try... This is an experimental manipulation. It's in the laboratory. We did try to give them a real dose of negative emotion to see whether it affects it. Of course, in everyday life, things are not exactly like this, but this is always with experiments. I mean, in the lab, you exaggerate the situation just to see whether it has an effect. We don't know exactly what happens in everyday life. The thing is, we had 206 images, and we selected the 150 which were really discriminating. I didn't think... No, it's a good... I have to go back and see whether the how many of the 75 images saw inactive people. I never thought of looking at that. It's only that we selected them depending on the emotions they create them. They created in their faces.
You had two questions.
Yeah, if you don't mind, I just have also one question about your conclusions. I'm not surprised that essentially you seem to be saying that for those people who experience some kind of solidarity, they feel some kind of more positive emotions. And I say it's not surprising because I've done a bit of work on sociology of enclaves and ghettos and so on. And if you look at that literature, for example, about Britain during the Blitz, or the Jewish ghettos during the Nazi period, or Sarajevo under siege, and so on, you find that not only do people talk about those periods afterwards with great nostalgia and say, well, okay, it was extremely difficult, but it was also one of the best periods of our lives because we were all together, we worked together, and so on. But you see that solidarity plays a very important role in overcoming the crisis. So I wonder what it is that you, from your study, that you think maybe preventing more of that sort of intense solidarity that you find in other crises of this sort. Is it political? Is it social?
I'm not sure I understand well. You ask what I think prevents solidarity. Is that what you say?
Well, you seem to be saying that it only appears at certain places, and apart from that, people seem to be more isolated.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. I'm sure, okay. Well, I think.
So, do we know from this literature that, for example, in the Blitz or in the ghettos, that these feelings were uniform or varied as with other, as you're suggesting, in terms of age or circumstance?
The general feeling is what Rebecca says, and I know it happens with social movements as well from the literature. The thing is, I think what is different in Greece now is that we might find more solidarity if people were not feeling trapped and very, very threatened at the individual level. Of course, if the situation gets worse, maybe people become, maybe there is more solidarity. But at the moment, it seems that some people are taking part in activism, and they're happy about doing that. Most people are just shocked, wait to see, and very much threatened about their own personal condition. We're in the process of it. I don't know, maybe when it's finished, some decades from now, we may see that there was more solidarity developing.
I think you depressed us sufficiently. You didn't need to add in decades from now. Anyway, comments, other comments or questions, please. Please.
It has been very interesting to me, especially the part where you talk about the interviews of groups of people. I just wonder, because I understood that the interview started in November, so before the election, first election of Syriza, until June, before the referendum. So there was maybe a period of comparative hope for those at least who voted for Syriza, because Syriza would come to power eventually in November, and then until June, well, maybe something would happen. So, and but I've seen a lot of young people, especially because I work with young people, so I don't know other people. Maybe this climate was a little specific compared to other periods of the crisis.
You are right. The problem is that during this year, we had been doing small researches all these years, but we had the funding the year that passed. So we were able to have a whole research team, and we had to finish this work within a year. It was actually, I didn't mention, it was funded by Michael Stathopoulos, who's Professor Emeritus and ex-Chancellor of the University of Athens, and he gave us the funding, and we had to do the research within the year, within the last academic year. And what we felt was that it was a very, very fluid period, because our findings might be biased, because the political situation changed so rapidly and so continuously, which really, I don't know whether I can compare the first interview with the last interview, because it's really different political situation. This is a problem. And we felt it continuously. We said, okay, now maybe we need more interviews, but even if we had more interviews, it would be we had to have another parameter then, which is how the political situation changes. So that was a problem.
One of your findings, of course, is that the young are more likely to be apathetic and a sense of hopelessness. This is not something you should be feeling in our discussion now. So any comments or any further questions in terms of the presentation? Please, Sandra.
Thank you for your paper. Very, very interesting. And I was, you know, as you were speaking, that perhaps your findings are biased because of the fluidity of the situation. I was thinking, no. I think this is one of the great strengths of what you presented, because in a way you captured the flow of a very difficult situation, and in time, these contradictions that you found will perhaps make sense, but it produced, I think, a very rich panorama of human feelings in the move, on the move, actually moving with a social and political situation. And I wanted to ask you a question about the problem of hope and the problem of political engagement, because I was intrigued that in your first study there was a decrease of hope but an increase in political engagement.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, how do you think that squares? Because I find, as the colleague mentioned, that political participation triggers feelings of empowerment and the possibility of change and counterbalancing hopelessness. And we know that hopelessness, as you said, is so terribly tragic in terms of, you know, what
apathy
prevents
for
the functioning of mind and for behavior and for the future, you know, of a society. So how do you see that?
You speak about the younger group who were lower in hope and political efficacy, but they showed increased intention for action.
They were hopeless and they didn't see the political efficacy with very good eyes, and yet
they were active in different ways.
And that is, I thought that was a very
It's difficult to interpret that. What Nicholas Demersis and myself, we were thinking about it. We wonder whether it may explain also violent acts in demonstrations, and anomic.
You mean political engagement that is less political and more an expression of aggression and frustration and exasperation?
Less rational.
Yeah. I'm not sure, you know, I'm hesitating to say that, but that may be an explanation. Another explanation is that they don't hope, they don't trust the political system, but they have to live, and if you have to live, you have to find things to do, to react. I don't know. I think we need to investigate that further qualitatively with younger individuals.
Was there also a any geographical spread, or these were individuals in Athens?
No, it was Athens.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Other comments, questions? I can see. Yeah, please. First of all, the lady in the Czech shirt. You.
I'm Greek and I'm from Bath, and there we had those very little political activity. So, sort of, from what you said, do you think these results are representative of the whole of Greece to any extent? Because the economic situation is so different in the islands, like in Santorini, so different in the smaller cities. So, how do you think that the emotions in different places have been affected?
I don't know. I mean, we haven't researched it, so I can't say. I can tell you from my experience, but this is not my experience. Is not research. Maybe in big cities, I don't know. Maybe in Salonika, we might find similar things. But again, I'm not sure, because I think the smaller a city or the smaller the town, the stronger the social network people feel they have, and perhaps the less the hopelessness, but this is just a bias.
And there are
the question I was asking.
Yeah.
Solidarity.
And there are cases of neighbourhood self-help in the crisis. There are examples of
some neighbourhoods in Athens, but not many. But okay. Some neighbourhoods have organised help for the people in need. But in Patras and Thessaloniki, I know they have. In other big cities. In smaller towns and in the islands, they don't need it because they have extended families who support the people who are in trouble. I don't know. My bias is that the biggest the city, the worse the situation.
Okay. Lady at the back.
This is a very interesting point. Although Seligman, who is the person who coined the term hopelessness, has been finding decades now that hopelessness is increasing in young people all over the world. So maybe it's not just social media. It may be technology, a more massive way of life, rhythms that change, that are much faster. I think the more general social condition. But it's interesting, your point about social media, I don't know. It's a good question.
It might have an effect in terms of political efficacy, in the sense that you can learn immediately about a demonstration, or you can learn about some political action through Facebook, etc. There's a greater communication.
So it makes you think that you are politically efficient?
Engaged.
Engaged.
You have the greater opportunity.
But you don't do much.
Yeah, good point. Okay, thanks. Katerina.
I ask a quick question about homelessness. You mentioned earlier that Greece scores higher on homelessness compared to other countries. I was wondering, what was the trend before the crisis in other countries, and how much that changed?
We had we did a research in 2000, again with Antonis Armenakis, my colleague, the statistician there, with a representative sample of Athenian students. And in that study, 15 years ago, we had found that the hopelessness score was much higher than the average American. We didn't have data from European students, even then, but for young people.
And how much that has changed?
I don't remember that. Maybe I have the figures here for the young individuals. But it increased significantly. If I have the figures, I will tell you. No, I don't. I can send them to you if you want. I'll give you the reference. It seemed that from even 15 years ago, we had a higher... It was 2.7. The score in the manual for American students, and Greeks had 4 point something back then, in 2000. And now we found it something about 5.6 or something like that. And to young men, 7. Gosh. Yeah, it's high.
Thank you. And Danny, you were going to ask a question.
I want to extend your point about the social media. I'm kind of proud because maybe it's an excuse for some people to say that, you know, they're engaged in their own way via social media.
Mm.
At the same time, having said that, it is a kind of engagement. I mean, for the very first time, we see a lot of Greeks, especially young Greeks, to actually have a political opinion, you know, to express political views, which was not the case, I assume, for the crisis. So even that, you know, contributing to the public sphere in a way or another, it's a kind of political game, but at least, you know, you're problematized about what's happening in your country, what's happening in your around you, which may be because of, you know, self-interest. You see your vocabulary going down, you see your quality of life going down, maybe. But, you know, that may be an explanation. That may be, you know, possible interpretation.
Gives the opportunity to express.
Mm. Yeah.
Other questions, comments, and Donnie?
I'm Antonio Salinas. I'm visiting the observatory from the University of Cyprus. Thank you very much for sharing this very important research. A colleague and I have tried to look at political action in Greece, mostly looking at survey and semi-experimental data using about 5,000 people. And so I'm really interested in this. At some point, you mentioned that, if I understood it correctly, political action or political activism was very high, especially in 2011, during the Agaractis movement, and then it dropped. And I'm wondering what kind of evidence we have that shows that the Agaractis was not the basically the exception, and that activity now is more in line with what it was before. In other words, what we have today, how low is it in terms of political activism compared to what we had before?
Thinking historically, one wouldn't label the Agaractis men as an exception. Thinking historically, I mean, thinking how Greeks resisted during the dictatorship and the Second World War and the student movement in the end of the dictatorship, only historically. Otherwise, I'm not sure we can judge. We don't know if it was an exception. We're in it. We are at the moment in it. So we don't really know how things will proceed. It was different, the Indignati, in compared to other movements in Greece. It was different.
It was also international.
It was international. Part of it was apolitical, with a traditional sense. Many people didn't belong to political parties. They were just out in the streets. I don't know.
Okay. Lady here, please.
My name is Ioanna Cusetti. I'm a PhD candidate in the Department of Methodology, and I look at here at the LSEM. I look at fear of crime in my research. Thank you for a great presentation. I have two methods-related questions. So the first one is about the first study. So if I remember when you mentioned that you used undergraduates in your sample, but then you talked about this positive correlation.
And postgraduates. undergraduate and graduate.
Okay, I was wondering about the age range.
It was 18 to 22 and 23 to 45.
Oh, yes.
So
the age range is larger in this
sector.
Yeah.
Great, thank you. And the second one relates to your third study. How did you recruit the research participants?
How we recruited them?
Yeah.
Okay. We made an invitation and put it in boards around the university, and we inviting people to speak about their experience, but it didn't work very much. It worked a bit. It was around in the street. We had some people coming this way, and then they introduced other people. This is why I said we actually combined Snowball with this is a weakness, because especially with the oldest age group, the Snowball might have brought us more leftists than they exist. But again, because it's a qualitative study, you know, you say, okay, you interpret what you have, keeping in mind the subjectivity.
Any other comments and questions?
Also related to methodology in the third study, what was the distribution of socio-economical groups?
I can't give you distribution because we didn't make a distribution. We asked them in the end what we wanted. We actually had people from different economic situations, but we didn't really make any table distributing the people because we didn't take that as a variable. We just wanted to hear what they say and then see it in relation to their personal condition. So if somebody was fired, it didn't really matter to us whether, you know, he or she had a well-paying job before, because we actually wanted to see how they experienced it.
Any other comments or questions? Gentlemen, right at the back.
Hi. I've been to the Greek island of Crete quite a few times, and if you look at the psychological standpoint of people there, they seem very different to those on the mainland. They seem quite happy and quite hopeful. And the main reason they give for this, many times if I ask people around, they say because they feel that Greek is somewhat financially separate the mainland, so I just wanted your standpoint on that, to see if that was the main point.
Well, Crete think, you know, it's the Crete, Christian pride. I think Cretes like to think of themselves as quite different from the rest of Greeks, so...
Perhaps the rest of Greeks feel that they are very different.
So maybe it would be interesting to do some, to take some interviews there in Crete.
Yeah, it's an interesting point about the different experiences of the islands as opposed to major urban centres. Mm. Certainly fascinating.
Thank you for the presentation. So I'm also Greek, and I belong to the middle-aged group.
Hopefully.
How tremendously transparent of you.
It was very interesting. It was like a single anecdotal evidence that I've experienced during the years of the crisis, all gathered in a research project. So thank you.
Yes.
And then from Thessaloniki, and I can reassure that the pictures were quite similar. I can imagine that there was a difference with Athens, but everything I saw, it was something that all of us seen during the crisis years in the city. So, just a minor point. You said that you didn't ask for income in the participants because you were actually more interested in seeing whether they
We knew what jobs they did, but we didn't ask income situation.
But I mean, again, from anecdotal evidence, because I don't really know, I think that it really mattered. So the family income did play the role on how desperate someone would feel. Even if someone was losing the job, in case that the family background was quite prosperous, he or she wouldn't end up in the same situation as probably someone that could not rely on family.
This is true, but this came usually came inside the interview. I mean,
okay.
If we reanalyze the interviews, we can record almost for every one of our participants approximately what kind of income level he or she came from. But we didn't really ask in the beginning or in the end. We just let them speak about it.
Yeah.
And speaking about it, people would say, you know, I mean, the couple of the two architects, the man who we interviewed, in the course of speech, he said, we used to earn that amount of money and we lived with this amount of money and we thought that it would always be like that and we spent everything and we didn't have anything in the bank and now we are without jobs. So we had information. If we go back to interviews, we can probably make a table of income. I don't know. But we didn't really took that. We didn't really used it as a different variable in this research, in the qualitative research.
Because, I mean, one of the main...
Because the thing is, the emphasis is on how you experience it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
It's more subjective than objective.
Good. Any last questions before we close? Before we close, let me simply mention that next week, Wednesday the 4th of November, we have our annual lecture, and this will be given by Professor Michael Hirstfeld, who's Professor of the Social Sciences and Curator of European Ethnology at Harvard University. And this will be on the 4th of November at 6:30 in the Hong Kong Theatre. 2 weeks today, Tuesday the 10th of November, we have our visiting fellow Dr. Platon Tinyas talking about rebasing intergenerational solidarity in post-crisis Greece, pensions, real property and family support. So I hope you will be able to join us for either or both event. Before we finish, can you join me in giving our warm thanks to Bettina for a fascinating presentation? Thank you.